Today's the 17th of November, 2014. And on behalf of the Hawke's Bay Knowledge Bank, I'm interviewing today Claude Davidson. And Claude's going to give us an insight into his family life. Claude, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Claude Davidson. I came to Hastings when I was 4 years old. First of all, I was born May the 20th, 1918. And the reason I got the name of Claude, because my uncle was fighting in the war, and they didn't think he'd come back from the war, and I was born, so straight away, that's how I got the name of Claude. But actually, it was supposed to have been Clyde, but they were so Scotch that straight away, the joker wrote it down as Claude, and so I remained at Claude from there on. I came to Hastings there, and Hastings was rather a small place. Everybody just about knew one another. It didn't go far without someone was mentioned and you knew them and everything. I went to Central School. I lived in 207 Southampton Street, and I used to wander down from there to Central School. And on the way, the train might begin and come, and we'd have a penny, and we'd put it on the railway line, and the train would run over it when it went past. It would see how much it flattened. And then we'd pass the old gas works there on the corner, a bit of smell of gas, and everyone have a nosy in the gate and think, oh, gee, was, you know, that's a great place. Then when I went on to Central School, the head of the Central School was Banks. He was a high flyer in the Banks, and I went there for quite a number of years till straight away they brought in zoning, and I was transferred to Parkvale. Well, I went to Parkvale, and it was quite a good school and everything like that. Wander through school, we'd wander through Beeson Park, which was a golf links, and I used to make my money there because they used to hit across the lake and straight away the balls were going down in the lake. So I had a good idea. I'd get up early in the morning there when no one was around, it'd be about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd head over to Beeson Park. And there were all the balls all in the lake there, spread out everywhere, and I'd think, oh, this was great. So I'd wade in there in the mud and everything and get them out. And then I'd take them home and scrub them all up, and I'd be back about 11 o'clock to sell them to the golfers. I used to get a shilling a time. That was marvellous, you know. So I enjoyed that. That was quite good. Beeson Park was quite a nice park and everything, and now it's changed to Windsor Park, and I still see it as Beeson Park. And there used to be a big Chinese garden just next to Beeson Park. But even Grove Road never went through to Karama Road when I was a boy. It used to just stop at Wooler Park Road, and then you had to walk through a paddock, and then you'd get into the other side of it and carry on up to Karama Road, up to the butchers up there on the corner there. But I'm starting to amble a bit. I better get back to Parkvale School. Now, I was there for a number of years. I was a dud student. I had no brains, and the teacher would turn around and say, all over two mistakes, you'd get the strap. Well, I knew I was going to get the strap before I started to get the spelling word. And I got a fair thrashing at school, because I seemed to be the one that seemed to cause most of the trouble. But straight away, when I left school, I had no brains, because I worked before school and after school. I worked in a place called Nutter's. Nutter's was on the corner of Karama Road and Heratonga Street. And straight away, I'd go there in the morning before school, and I'd sweep the shop all out behind the counters and clean all up. And then the next job, I'd go off to school. But after school, I'd come in to deliver the parcels everywhere. The parcels had to go out anywhere. I needed a raincoat one time, so they said, oh, well, we'll buy the raincoat and you can pay a shilling a week off it. Well, I only got 5 shillings a week. So that was a shilling, that was 4 shillings a week I got for doing the job. But on Saturday mornings, I had to clean all the mirrors in the shop, and I had to clean all the windows down Karama Road. And they went right down to McDormand's, the saddler. He was there. And that was an interesting place, because all the saddles used to be made there, and the windows would be all open, and the saddlers would be all working, and you'd be able to go along and talk to them, because they always put the window up next to their bench when they were making saddles. But that was quite good. But I went off to the school from there. But time went on, and I grew up, and straight away I went to work. I went to work for Cudbee and Kilt. Now, Cudbee and Kilt were both used to work for Peach's Garage. And Peach's Garage was a Ford place, and they sold cars and they repaired cars and everything. And Kilt was the salesman, and Cudby was a mechanic. And because Peach's used to sell cars, the cars would come in and be on a flat deck on the railway, and they would actually sell the car from there, because no one had a lot of money, and the farmer would buy the car off the deck of the train, and away it would go, and he'd go home with his car, and the bank would pay out the money for the car, and that's how that went. But Cudby and Kilt were a couple of miserable people, hard to work. If a car came in and the tyres had to be pumped up, I pumped them up by hand and checked all the tyres all around and everything like that, and talked to the people that come, mostly farmers and old Model Ts and everything like that. And we used to repair them there and do all the jobs on the cars. And then straight away, my wages were climbing up a little bit. So Cudby and Kilt, being miserable people, thought, oh, I've got to get rid of this joker. So they put me on to Thompson Motors. And of course, Thompson was a very genuine person. He was back from the army and everything, and he was just in business because he first went into business in the Dodge garage opposite the railway station. And straight away, he went out to his, where they got this building built on Carrima Road. Mossman built the building, and straight away Thompson went into it. And he took me on, and of course I was pretty good at customers and looking after customers and working away there, and often on weekends he'd leave me the whole place to run and look after. But then along came the war, and all the garages were shutting down for tyres and petrol and everything like that, and then we were out of a job. So I thought, well, this is no good. I had a young family, I'd just been born not long, and I thought, well, I've got to have a job. So I walked off down to get a ride out to Whakatū. So I went and saw the chief engineer, Mr. Love, and he was a very old Scotch engineer. And he said, well, ring me back at 7 o'clock tonight. I'll see how you're going. So I rang him back and said, oh, I had a job. So that was great. So then I got my bike out, and I made my bike reasonably sound, and I biked every day to Whakatū. Now they all go to the gym, and they'd all be at the gym now to get their exercise. I didn't need to go to a gym. I turned around and got my exercise getting to work, because I was always running late, and I had to go eyes out all the way to Whakatū, and because my lungs were worked out very good, and that's how I lived to be an old age. That's how it went there. That I got a job there, and I did very well there. We used to cut girders for the buildings and measure them all up and drill all the holes for the bolts, and then the girders would go up, and then all the Whakatū would be built, and then straight away the welders would come along and weld all the beams to the uprights. But I could run the freezing works. It wouldn't matter what department it was. I could run any department. But if the other fitter was away from that department, I could turn around and put the apprentice there, and I could look after any department and keep it going. So I had a lot of skills there. And then we put in boilers, and we learned how to assemble a new boiler and do all the tubes and expand the tubes and everything like that through building the new boilers and things like that. I learned how to overhaul the steam engine that used to run. That used to be quite good, because after I finished overhauling it, I could take it down the track and have a drive out of the engine. I thought, oh, this is all right. This is good. I'm enjoying this, you know. And then after that, there was other things to fix. Everything seemed to be fixed. Often somebody's car, and they'd see the boss and say, look, Claude, have a look at my car. It's not going too good. And the boss would say, well, you better go down the end and have a look at it down there, because, you know, you can't give him too long. So I'd check over their cars for them, and I got on quite well with everybody. It didn't matter where they were on the chain or down in the fitting shop on the cart and making the barrels and everything like that. And I enjoyed that, getting on with people. So then that was getting a bit miserable, and I thought, oh, I'll have a change. I think about time I had a change. So I thought, this will be good. I'll go and get a job at Watties. They were a young firm coming on and everything like that, and they were starting to get on quite good, and, you know, and I got a job there. And first job I applied for the job, it was Briggs the engineer, and he's turned around and said, I don't know how good you are. And I said, well, I don't know how good the firm is to work for. It might be a lousy firm to work for, but I tell you what, we'll have an agreement. I'll work for you for 3 weeks, and if you don't like me, you fire me. And they said, oh, we'll take you on at that. That's all right. So the first job they gave me, was putting decks on trucks. They're expanding, and Jimmy bought these trucks, and the decks had to go on them, and the hydraulics had to work. But before I arrived, the foreman had another truck he'd done, and he had all the trouble in the world, and he couldn't get it to work and everything. So when I went in, everybody was watching the trouble I was going to have. So when I did these trucks, I did first one up, and Ray was sitting in the window. He used to work in the office there, and he watched me there, and he watched me working out in the yard. And I put the deck on the truck and everything, and then I got in and put the oil in and put the hoist up, and up the word first pop. Oh, gee, this is pretty good. He must know what he's doing. So the second truck, they watched that, and that worked exactly the same. And the third truck, and they all worked good. I was number one straight from the start. Jimmy thought I was marvellous, and Ray was telling Jimmy how good I was and everything like that. And Briggs gave me a ride straight away for us working there, and he said, oh, you know, this is good. So Jimmy goes and brings out all the old labellers and all the old junk he couldn't get working and everything. And I had all these labellers in the yard, and bring this one out and bring that one out, and Claude will fix them all. And then the chap in the can plant thought, well, this joker's not a bad joker. We need somebody for the second shift to run the can plant. So what about we get him in the can plant? So he went and saw Jimmy, and Jimmy hummed and hard and everything like that, and thought, oh, yeah, that'd be a good place. You need night shift there running the can plant. So I went into the can plant, making cans and cutting plate for the seam, the machines that cut the plate for the cans and make the seamers and put the rubber in the joints and everything. And so I was in charge of the night shift running the can plant. And we used to make 300 cans a minute then. That was slow compared to today. But straight away we made cans, because that was a machine that was put in during the war for the Americans. Americans put the body maker in and all the can plant and everything into Watties. Can plant was a very good thing for Jimmy. So I used to run the can plant there at night and work with different ones that the cans used to run all night. We used to fill up the whole factory with empty cans, so that when the season came, you could break them down, all the stacks of empty cans, and then you'd have cans to feed right through all the time. So I had that for a while, and then Jimmy wanted to build a factory up in Gisborne. So he thought, oh, here you are, Claude. I'll send him up to Gisborne, and he can set up the factory up there. So away I go to Gisborne and everything like that. So in the meantime, Gordon had been out and bought a house, and he'd bought this house up there for me to live in. And I thought, oh, this is all right, I've got a place to live in. And I went up there, setting up the factory. And then I had to encourage the wife to go to Gisborne, and she wasn't too happy about going to Gisborne. She said the family need the schools and everything like that around her and everything like that. And straight away, you know, like, I don't really want to go to Gisborne. So any rate, Jimmy went on, and I had to hum and haw, will I go to Gisborne or won't I go to Gisborne? And then straight away, I had an argument with Jimmy over the house. The house didn't have enough rooms in it. And this where the point came, where I came back to Hastings, he's going to carry on up in Gisborne. And I was sitting down, he's opening letters down one end of the table, and I'm sitting down the other end, and he's arguing about it. And I said, well, the wife says the house is too small. You know, like, you never get the kids. I had four kids then, and they had to go into there, and there wasn't enough room in it. So I said, I bought the house, and straight away, it's a nice house. I quite agree, there's nothing wrong with the house, but it's too small. And Jimmy says, oh, you could put the boys in the wash house. And I said, bloody hell, I'm not sticking them in the wash house. You wouldn't stick Ray and Gordon in the wash house, and I'm bloody certain I'm not sticking mine. I'm not going to work there. He said, well, you come back and work in Hastings. No, sure, I says, my labour's worth far more than sell it to you. I'd sooner turn around and pack it in and go back, and I'll go back to Whakatū. So I get on the phone, I ring up Whakatū, and they said, start whenever you're ready. So I go back to Whakatū. And I went back there for another 4 years. And then after that, I thought, no, I better have a change. I'll go back to the food industry. So Unilever were just setting up in Hastings. This is 1957. And they were just starting to set up. And I thought, oh, this is a good setup. I could set up their machinery everywhere around, the compressors and everything needed installing, and all the boilers needed to be mounting up and everything. This is a good challenge. I'll have this on. So I went to Unilever. I did very well there. It grew and everything like that. And then they were going to take another firm on. It was Butlins. Butlins were up in Auckland. That was another war place that had been set up in Kohi. And that was set up there for the war, during the war. And Butlins made all their things and that there. And straight away, Unilever took them over. The factory had to be emptied out there. I emptied out all that factory and sent it down to Hastings. And that was quite a good job too, emptying that factory. And that was a start for me. And so I came back to Hastings. And then they needed somebody to run Watties. So I got a job running all the can plant in there, in charge of all the can plant there. And we had a lot of machinery that used to process all the tomatoes and everything like that. I had an Italian come out to install the machine, and of course he couldn't talk English, so I had to get an interpreter for him. And that went along, and we got this machine all installed, and we used to do all the tomato paste. Broke the tomatoes down there, you couldn't get them down unless this machine was going, and water right down and made the paste, and that got rid of all the tomatoes around the area. Then I went from there, and straight away, while I was working for Unilever, I got made operations engineer. And then a job came up because we'd taken a factory over, which was Fropack, and it used to belong to Timona Freezing Works. It was Fropack that was working there, and as soon as Unilever took them over, we turned around and took all their staff and everything like that. So anyway, that factory, they were wanted to start another factory down in the South Island, and they wanted this factory emptied out and taken down to Christchurch. So I thought, oh, this is a good challenge, so I thought I'll have this on. So I emptied out all the factory in Coventry Road, which consists of compressors and a freezing tunnel and all the cannery stuff and everything. Quite a nice little factory and everything like that. And I went down to Christchurch, and of course the labour was available down there. I employed all the labour there to install the factory and knocked them into shape there and everything like that. So the factory was installed. I was down there for 3 months putting the factory in. And I used to send the wife home every third week to mow the lawns and clean the house up and everything like that. So she used to fly home there, and I was entitled to come home every 3 weeks to the break, but it was too long a break to come away from the factory. When the job I had, I only had 3 months to do the whole job, and I had to set it all up down there. So anyway, I finished the job and everything, and the peas came in and the viners went out and everything. And that was that. And then I came back to Hastings, carried on working for Unilever. I used to do the harvesting. I was harvesting manager, and that consists of quite a big organisation. You had to employ 70 students to start with, and that needed buses and everything to organise. You had to have buses to take them out to the fields, because we used to harvest round Teco and Onga and all out that district like that, and all around. So I had to set it all up. And actually the pupils were quite good. The young ones used to come in. They used to come back each year for another job, because they made all their money at the factory. They didn't have to get a student loan or anything. They were working 12 hours a day working, and in that time there was 3 hours on top of that. There was 15 hours they would get paid for, because that was a travelling time getting to Teco and all around like that. And they were always good. And often the night shift used to sleep out on the beach there all the day. They'd come in from work, they'd have a shower in the factory, then they would turn around and go out on the beach and sleep there. And around about 3:30 or so, they'd get themselves together, come into work, and then they would turn around and have another shower in the factory and get in the bus, and 4 o'clock they'd leave and go out at all. Because on the way they'd picked up a slab of meat and then picked up a loaf of bread and a pound of butter, and they lived on that out on the field. Because we always had a hot plate in the field. The fire was always going, the wood was always around from the farmer, and they just light the fires, and there was a hot plate on theirs. And straight away they'd cook their food on that, and they lived on that. But I tell you what, the Maori Doug, he was in charge of that gang, and he used to make tea. And did he make strong tea? He never emptied the teapot. He just threw another handful into the billy. And it used to get, you could stand the spoon up in it. And we always talk about Charlie's tea, you know. We always knew about Charlie's tea, you know. And when I used to go out checking on everything, I often had a cup of tea there, and it was strong. But that's how the field used to go. But I enjoyed all the students. They were quite good. they'd have all their little arguments and I'd have to go out and straighten them up and everything like that. And then they'd turn around and say, oh, we want this and the award. And I'd say, well, what about the travelling? Oh, I'll do something about the travelling. No, leave everything as it is, Claude. We won't worry about what we're complaining about there. And everything would be peaceful again. But it was quite a job. If the viners were rolled over, it was my job to go and pick the viner up because I had to make sure the viner be across the road. I had one across the road at the bottom of Tiaute Hill and it was blocking the road up. And that was quite a job picking the viner up again because I had to turn around and contact the power board. I had to contact the telephone people and everything because they had to look at their side of the building. And then I had to get the cranes out and we'd pick the machine up and stand it on its feet. And I put that one round the back of Tiaute because it was in the middle of the night when I was doing all this work. I put it round the back of Tiaute pub and I'd pick it up next day. But straight away, the students were good there. You had to turn around and discipline them. The machines were very dangerous to drive and they were high up and everything like that. And they would roll over very easy. I'd pick up many in a paddock and that, and one chappie broke both wrists jumping out of it when it was going over. But you had to turn around and keep an eye on the staff, and often they would tomfoolery to go on and they might roll the machine, but if they roll the machine, I'd stand them down straight away. I'd stand them down for 3 days because I'd be wound up over the machine going over because I had to get it fixed again to get it out working. And I'd turn around and stand them down and then I'd bring them in. And if they'd been tomfoolery, they were fired. There was no argument about it. They were fired. And straight away, if the bridge had given away or the bank had given away, they went straight back to work again and carried on. And that's the way it was run. Because I had to discipline them because the rest of the fields were watching what I did and how I disciplined them when I didn't want trouble there. And this is how it would all go. But it was an interesting job. I used to enjoy it. I used to run the factory in the mornings at the factory and see everything was right. In the afternoons, I'd take off down to Tikko, Onga, and all around the district, checking everything that was behaving itself and what was doing, and everyone was keeping the machines going, and they were getting properly looked after and everything like that. But I had one chap working at night down there and the factory was full up and chock-a-block and they stopped the fielding for a while. And so he thought it'd be a good idea to put everybody in the bins and take them to the pub out at Tikko. And of course, when I came to work next day, I knew straight away where he'd been and in the pub. And straight away, I called him in, I fired him. And when I fired him, I said to him, now, if you go to Tasmania and you mention my name there, he'll give you a job straight away. And the joker said, oh, this is good. He was a good chap. And the way he went to Tasmania, he got a job in the peas over there because I had a good connection with them in Tasmania and the factories over there and everything like that. So that was quite interesting too. I used to go over there and see how they harvest and everything like that. And that's how it went. That was quite a good life. And then Unilever, well, I retired from Unilever. They're a very good firm to work for. They looked after their staff and all they could do for their staff. You never had to worry there. I went to London once for the firm, and I was out of kilter there. We went out for dinner there. They were always looking for someone to take out for dinner from overseas. And we went to a place, and straight away, we had a room to ourselves. And for dinner, you had game. Whatever it was all game. And straight away there, I had a waiter standing behind me, which annoyed me straight away, but I had to go along with the stream and play me part that I was from overseas and play the part and everything. That really annoyed me there. But there, well, that's the way it went. And I retired from Unilever, and Max Graner was the director there, and we got on well together. After that, we used to go up to the guide's place at Carew. And we used to often do repairs up there, needed and everything like that around there. So that was my history there. But Hastings is a great place and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else in Hastings.
It's a wonderful life you've had.
A good, enjoyable life. Turkey Lowe was our buyer and he had big feet. You could get a bottle of beer into his shoes. No trouble. And they were big bottles of beer and I'm not talking about the ones they have today. I'm talking about the big bottles. But Turkey was a hell of a good joker. He got on with everybody. If Max and I and the rest of them, Barry Pick and all those people, were out at the pub at Havelock, and we used to go there often on Friday afternoons and have a letdown of what's gone on during the week. And if turkey came in, there'd be always three jugs would come across to our table. But turkey, I admired turkey. How he got the name of Turkey Low, he used to work in the Rickerton factory down in Christchurch, and he bought all these turkeys, and straight away he had them, they were all alive, and what did I do with these turkeys? So he wrung all their necks, and they were there ready for Monday, because this was Saturday when he brought them in. And straight away, they were there ready for Monday. So he got his name as Turkey then. From there on, he was always to us Turkey Low. And I watched him go through from the butcher's shop in Hastings, and I'd see him out there with his apron on, scrubbing the floors and everything like that. He was a worker, and that's how he got where he was, with the freezing works and everything like that. Because actually, when I worked the freezing works, Lex Waterhouse, I don't know if you ever knew Lex Waterhouse, but I got him the job at Wakatoo. He used to work with me at Watties, and he finished up at Watties. And I said, oh, I guess you'd go to Wakatoo, and I got him a job. He finished up at Wakatoo in the factory, putting the factory together down in Takapau. He had a stroke and everything. I always felt sorry for Lex, you know. And that was Turkey Low, anyway. When I got the job of operations engineer, I had no paperwork or the letters or anything. Anything at all, I could. I was made operations engineer because I could fix everything. We were coming into the age of electronics, and electronics used to be quite in the early stage. And we had machinery coming in that would turn around and weigh the peas as they went in, would make the bag, form the bag, and drop it out ready for it to go to be packed to go to the customer. But straight away, you had right down to three peas falling would be the weight. So the weight was really right, and we'd work on those. And that's how that used to go. But I was pretty dumb at paperwork, and the chief engineer, he wasn't much good at running the factory. So we come to agreement. He would do all the paperwork, anything I wanted in paper, he would do it. And I'd run all the factory. I'd run everything in the factory. So a decision would be made there. Straight away, Max and Barry, I'd come up with an idea and everything like that, and they'd say, oh, that sounds good. And Barry would say, I'll go away and have a yarn to Max. And then they'd go away there, and then when the time they come back, I'd instrumented it, and it was all running by the time they come back. I didn't wait to get an OK, will we do that or won't we do that? I'd go ahead and do it. And they used to get very frightened of me, because I'd go ahead and do something straight away. I wouldn't turn around and wait for a boss to make a decision. But Barry and I worked right through to our retirement, and I retired there. Because I used to do all the plant. You had to have an inventory of all the plant in there. If you discarded a line, you had to get rid of that machinery. You had to go down to the dump and cut up and get rid of it, get it off the books, because it was taking up a lot of the profit. So you had to do that. And I had to look after that. And after I retired, they come along and I said, Claude, will you come back to work and finish off this? Nothing's been done since you left. And the plant needs all straight, because they were getting ready to close the plant down and sell it. And every plant had to have a number on it. And I thought about it and everything. I said to the wife, I've retired. I'm not going to go back. And I didn't go back.
Right.
So they had to get another chappie to do all that work and do that job.
If you went back, you'd be going back.
I'd go over it all the time, and I'd be on the contract doing the job. It'd be a contract job to do it. And I didn't want the money and taxation and looking out that side of it, because your wife used to do all white paper work, and then I wasn't going to burden her with that, you know. So that's how it used to go. That's where a person doesn't need a lot of brains in that area to get to the top like that, you know. So that's how it went. Paperwork, I don't like it at all. Two doors from us. And we lived together all the time. If you had an evening, they'd do their part. And the Harmons grew up now. He got up to in charge of the TV in Auckland, you know. And then he went over to London running all the TV and the BBC and everything like that. He's got houses in London and all around. He's got houses in Auckland. He's got boats in Auckland. He's on my iPad. The whole family's on my iPad. And straight away, one son went overseas with my son. They went to Europe and all around Europe. And he was next in charge of the Herald paper. He's only just retired. I went over to his place in Napier not long ago. And he's retired out and shifted down from Auckland down there. But he was the one that took the photo of a burial of all the Maoris on the hill. And the way he got up out there and he fed them out films, the Maoris let him get through and it without any trouble. And he got right up to the ground. He got this great photo of it carrying the casket up the hill with all the Maoris. It was a very high Maori it was, had all the cloaks over the coffin and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he finished up next in charge of the Herald there, right up till he retired. He said, I'm stopping there. I'm waiting for my big redundancy rather than retire. But in the finish, he retired. You know,
mm.
I still see him, I still talk to him, but the whole family, Brent Harmon, he did well too. He was in Parliament, running Parliament there mm. and everything like that. He was a reporter there before he got in television and everything. That family, we all grew up together. Dad Harmon used to be in the chemist shop at UFS, opposite Lockyer's, where Lockyer's used to be. That family, they've done so well, you know, and they still know me well. Of Nigel's father. It was always Nigel. Well, his son did very well too. He owned a motel opposite the Campbell statue in Cornwall Park. But it was high class. Everything was spot on. He changed the carpets every so often. He never drained it. He put more into it all the time. In the finish, some Asians bought it off him. And now he's got a big house, you know. Another one of his sons built a swimming place in Turin. He's got a place North Auckland. And he's got a fishing lodge down in Turin. So they've done well too. Good to see them do well too. But one of my sons overwintered in the Antarctic. He used to be in the Navy and then he went down to the Antarctic and he looked after all the food and everything, put the Christmas parties on and everything for them in the Antarctic. And that was in the early days. And his photo is in the hall now up in the Antarctic.
Well, but what a life.
So even with the family, I've enjoyed the family too, you know.
Claude, I've got to thank you for that talk.
Well, I hope I didn't bore you.
Not at all, no. I'm wide awake. I couldn't go to sleep and doze off or anything like that.
Well, straight away, you turned around and said, you interview Hastings. And I started to scratch my head and I went, what the hell do I know about Hastings? You know, I knew all the shops were, but I don't know anything about Hastings, you know. And I've lived here all my life. But, you know, like I knew where the rivers used to go around to Hastings, the back of, I lived in a railway house in Willow Park Road, and the back of there, the river flowed all through that area. That was just a bare paddock when I was growing up. Because after the earthquake, we couldn't live in our house. So when my father worked on the railway, we got all these railway covers there underneath the trees in the house next door. We hung all these up there. Then I went in and got the mattresses out of the house, and we dragged them across to there. And then we built the fireplace up and with a couple of bricks and a hot plate. We did all our washing and the horse trough that was all there. There was a well right next on the property and it used to pump water all the time and it had a horse trough there. And you did all your washing and everything in the horse trough. But that was after the earthquake, you know. And we stopped for 5 days before we were evacuated to Palmerston. I sat on the back of a truck and they took me to Palmerston. My mother went off in another car and I had to find her when I got to Palmerston. I can always remember the earthquake when I was at Parkvale School and the swimming bath and the water went up. You know how you get a thing and you splash it backwards and forwards and the water went right up in the air. I can still see that water way up in the air, you know, in the swimming bath there. If you don't get up and go, you'll be here tomorrow morning and I'll still be talking. Because what I do when I start talking is I live here and I might go 2 or 3 days and never talk to anybody.
Yeah,
don't see anybody. 2 or 3 days, then I don't want to go out. I've got enough tucker in there. I've got my tucker and I'm well stocked up there. But the neighbours are very good. They'll often come in and bring me in some, by doing some baking and bring it in. But I get on well with people around here. Wouldn't have it any other way. And I'm going to Auckland for Christmas. This morning, my son rang up. He said he's got this new Italian car, big flash car. I'd love to drive down. I'll drive down and pick you up. And otherwise, I'd have to fly up, you know. I fly up to Auckland and he picks me up at the airport, you know, and then the way I go, brings me down, I fly home again. Now he said, yeah, I might drive down. He said, oh, you can catch up on me. Well, all the mischief I've got up to down here, you know. So he came down, I'll go up there for Christmas. But they're having 26 people for Christmas, you know. So that'll be a big Christmas.
Yep. Well, I wish you a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, same to you.
And a Happy New Year.
And it's not the last you'll see of me.
I'll be back to see you.
Yeah. When the sun comes down, I'd like to take him out to have a look at out there.
More than welcome.
Yeah. And I'll say, there's the box. You leave your subs in on the way out.
So I went down the road, did a good test, passed on that. So I got my driver's license.
At 103?
Yeah, 103. And I'm still driving, but, you know, you turn around and you get more careful all the time. You're not as good as what you did. You throw the car around and this, that and everything and, you know, don't care much and everything. But now I'm 103, I get to the roundabout, I have a look at it carefully and whatever's coming and that, and be careful whatever you're doing. Because I think I'm 100%.
So tell me, when did you first get your licence?
I got my licence when I was 14. And it was an old Model T Ford. I was working for Cudbury and Kelt at the time. And they said, no, the truck's not going too good. You can't go for your licence. And because me being so young and made a big thing with the authorities going for your licence, that was a big thing to me. I wasn't going to let them down. Doesn't matter what the boss said, you know. He came secondary, so down I went for my licence. And the licence judge said, Jesus, this truck's running rough and everything. Move over, I'll drive it, and you sit next to me. So he took me all around everywhere, and he's sitting next to me. So I got my licence anyway, and the boss was a bit crook when I got back, and he said, did you get your licence? I said, yes. So that was a feather in his cap. I did have my licence working in the garage. And, you know. But I taught myself to drive, really, because I used to have to get it every morning. All the cars were parked in the garage and they had to be put out to make space. So I knew you put your foot on the clutch and put them into gear and the car moved off and everything like that. But I never thought about stopping because I got to a big 40-gallon drum in the Robinson, flattened that and everything like that. Now I realise the brake and put my foot on the brake. But that's how you learn to drive. You gradually pick it up like that, you know. So that was my driving licence. And then I had a new push bike, and a chap come in the garage, and he said, I should have bought a push bike. I said, I just bought one. He said, do you want to make a swap? I said, yes, I'll make a swap. So he went out on my push bike, and I went out in the old Model T truck. When I took it home, I took the family out to the beach and everything like that. And the family changed, you know, because they never had a car. You know, my father worked on railways and few people had cars in those days, you know. That was the early part of my life, you know. That's how things pop up, you know. You're learning all the time. Yeah, it doesn't matter what, I'm still learning and I'm 103.
You must be a special person to be able to live on your own and have your own company because not everybody can do that.
Well, you only got one life. It's your life, and you've got to run it as you can. I sit here, I look out the window, and I go out and do a bit of gardening. If I go to mow the lawn, the neighbour comes out and grabs it off me and won't let me mow the lawn. So she mows the lawn and she keeps an eye on me. And things potter along. If she's done some extra baking, she'll bring some in for me so I have a nice afternoon tea. But people are very good. People are very good to old people. If I have a fall, I hardly hit the ground and someone's there to pick me up, you know. So you don't got to worry about things, you know. You don't got to get downhearted because the clouds are out. You get a sunshine day and you enjoy every bit of it, you know.
Now, your family, in your own family, how many children?
I had a sister 15 months older than me, and I had a son who was younger than me, so a boy younger than me. But he was born during the earthquake, and he was never 100%, you know. He was always shaky, and that. My mother was carrying during the earthquake, and she was thrown around in the house at the time. So he never married, but he grew up. He died about 3 years ago, you know, but he lived a life, his own life.
And what about your parents? What age did they live to?
Well, they were in their 60s and 70s, but I've lived longer, you know. I always said to my doctor, you know, I'll die of cancer because my father died of cancer and uncles died of cancer. And because he said, no, not necessary. But I got a very good doctor. He made that photo up there for me. That's the day I was born, where I was born. And it was in that paper, in that newspaper. But I've done well for my doctor, you know, because my 100th birthday, he arrived on his motorbike over at the mission. He said, oh, I wasn't letting it go past your birthday without coming saying hello, you know. So Christmas time he arrived out here on his motorbike. He said, I'm just going around the nurses, you know, to wish them a happy new year, man. And I said, got everything today and everything went. I didn't even ask him in for a drink, you know. So next time I went, I had to take a bottle of wine to him, you know, and the nurses, take a bottle of wine to the nurses. So, no, people do things for you. And you're so shocked in yourself when they're doing it, you don't think right, you know. It's not so after they've gone, you analyse what you've done and all the wrong way you went wrong, you know.
My dad used to say, it's better and easier to give than to receive.
Well, it is. I've got a block of chocolate on there or something like that. I like to think, yeah.
And now your own children, how many do you have?
I had four boys. Four boys, yes. And now they're millionaires. My son has just sold his house for $4.4 million. It's in the book up here. And they did a whole thing on it, all in the book. Two books were for men.
Is this local?
In Auckland.
Oh, in Auckland.
Yeah. Your children always do better than you do. Those times are very hard. Nobody had any money, and everybody shared everything. You shared, if you had surplus vegetables, they went over to your neighbour. And if he had surplus, it came up. We used to get a sack of potatoes, those tall sacks, every year from across the road that people bring across. And those potatoes lasted. They don't last today. Your potatoes are built to get the second crop out of them. They get re-crop again. They're like tomatoes are the same. They last in the supermarket. Everything's changed from our time.
It's not for the better, Matt, is it?
No, it's not for better. It's for the supermarket so they don't go off. They get up to a red like that and they sit there. And they can sit there for a week and they get no more ripe. Now out in the paddocks or waddies and that, they grow their tomatoes and then they spray them. And that ripens them all evenly like that. They bring them in and process them. That's how that's done, you know, totally different.
So you've got one son in Auckland.
Yes, I've got a son out in Australia.
Whereabouts?
Way up north in Auckland, in Australia. He's been over there for quite a number of years. And then the other son spent his time down the South Pole there when the time the dogs were down there. That's him over there. And that photograph is on the wall of the Antarctic. A photographer down there at the time took the photo, put it up on the wall, and it's on the wall of the Antarctic. But he's flying over the South Pole and that.
So where's he now?
He's in Auckland, retired. But his wealth is in houses. He buys houses in Auckland there now, and that's his return, you know, rather than have the money in the bank, you know. So he's got about three or four houses in Auckland. Their grandson is working on the big thing in Auckland, under the, you know, where they're building the whole thing in Auckland. He's a foreman there with all the people there. His father gave him a ticket to go overseas when he was 21, and he toured Germany and these places. He got a lot of experience on concrete and things like that, different parts of the world. He come back now, he's working for Fletcher's. He keeps me informed of what's going on, how they're digging down there for the stations and things. And I want to know where the earth goes, you know, because there's some earth, you know.
Mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yes, yes, what they're doing just now.
How many grandchildren have you got?
I've got about 17, and great-great-grandchildren. So my grandchildren have got children. My great-grandchildren have got children.
So you're their great-great-grandfather?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Hey, are you? Well, they all come for me 100th birthday, and that was quite good because they all met one another. Life goes on. They would have never met one another, but they all got together and they were chatting away and this and that. And the chatter was going on all the time over at the mission.
Actually, you would be a rarity.
Yeah. Well, straight away, I've lived a good life. I'm 103 now. And it's getting harder for me to live, to get around. My legs are not as good as what they were. And life is getting harder. And I say, this is my last birthday, 103. I'll have my birthday, last one. So my granddaughter leaves Dunedin University, flies up, comes to my birthday, flies back next day, you know. And the children, I've got a grandson, he just started out to be a plumber. And he's bought a house. So, you know.
It was a chip off the old block.
Well, straight away, he smashed his car up and he was out of car. And I said, you turn around and save $1,000 and come back with me and show me $1,000 and I'll cover it with another $1,000. Oh, he went without his lollies and his this and that and everything. saved $1,000. He was here no time at all. So I said, you write the cheque for $1,000. I made him write the cheque for $1,000. Then he got his car. Now that's really set him down how to save. And now he saves, he's shifted into this place he bought. He got all his mates shifting in with him. So all the houses, both sides, will be for sale in no time. He'll be buying those. You see the families coming on. I like to see them establish themselves. No dope, everything, and run a good life, a clean life, and everything like that, you know.
How old were you and your wife when you got married?
My wife was 16 and I was 20. And we both were fine fathers and mothers. And she was a great cook, rice stove. She could cook a roast dinner and everything like that. And that's how the family went on. I was married for 75 years. I got a thing from the Queen saying 75 years, you know, and I had one over 100, you know. So the Queen couldn't come over to my birthday because she's having trouble with her family, straightening out her family.
You and your wife worked as a team, that would be right?
Oh, yes, yes. She was the one that laid the law down. It was always, wait till your father comes home, you know. But we had a good life because that was the best time of your life when your children are growing up. You're around the table, you're debating what you've done for the day and everything like that, and what went wrong and what didn't go wrong and who got into a bit of trouble and who didn't, you know, kids. But I made them, if they wanted to push for it, they had to go and get a job and work for it and give me half done. And I'd pay the other half. They grew up that way. They'd say we would value our bike, you know, they'd value things because they had a half share in it, you know. I had the other half. But if I worked hard for the kids, the pay pack would come home and go straight to the wife, run the household. And she ran that and she handled the money, she handled the paperwork, and I just did the work and supplied the... When the kids were five, she would work the wallpaper. She would be really good at colour and everything like that. She did the office work and worked there. And that's when we got our first fridge. We had extra money, she got a fridge. Of course, we had the fridge. The kids all wanted ice cream, so she had the mixer for the ice cream, you know. But that was life, you know. If we went to the beach in somebody's car and they'd leave me the car for the weekend, everybody along the street went with us to the beach. There was always enough food. The wife always had enough food. And even those children today will come up and hello, Mr. Davidson, and speak to me, you know, have a yarn with me. Because not only does your family grow up, but the people there. One boy there, he was the head of television in New Zealand, Wayne Harmon, and then he went to London and he was head of television over there. So those children grew up. Another boy there, cracker with my son when he was in Auckland, and they still meet one another now. He was next to the photographer in the Herald paper. So all those people have grown up with a family. We've got one big family. They're part of a family too, you know.
Now, out of all the jobs you had, which one would you say was the best job you ever had?
Well, all the jobs contributed to my finishing jobs because I worked at the works, I worked on boilers, I worked on refrigeration. I got all that experience of refrigeration. I turned around and went to Watties and I was in charge of the can plant there, making more cans. I got on well with Jimmy Watty. And I took a factory from Hastings to Gisborne and put a corn in Gisborne. I'd taken factories from the Popatch factory around in Hastings, took it to Christchurch and reassembled it in Christchurch. And I've taken closed down factories, Street's Ice Cream in Palmerston. I bought Butman's factory down from Auckland down to Unilever's factory in Hastings. So I had a terrible lot of experience with people. Handling people.
So which was your best job, though?
Well, probably I was operations engineer for Unilever. And everything was moved was my responsibility. And that time, electronics were just coming in. So the machinery came in with electronics equipment. And you had to learn the electronics in those machines. For all the wrapping work around the peas was all new. It was getting developed. And often it wouldn't have enough slip in it to go through the machinery. You'd have to reject that reel and put another reel in. And I'd go back to Auckland and complain about these reels and that. I'd go to Australia, see them harvesting peas, because I was harvesting manager as well as operations engineer. I had two managers' job at the same time. I did all the harvesting for Unilever on their peas. Took on 70 students. So I was amongst people all the time.
So you're a real people person.
Well, I've worked with people all the time.
So who was the best boss you had?
Well, both Max Grainer, he was director of Unilever, and Jimmy Watty would be the other one. Jimmy Watty was a very good boss. He knew everybody's name, first name, in the factory. And when he walked into the factory, it was good morning, so-and-so, good morning, so-and-so. And he addressed everybody like that. But when I went to work for him, the foreman had put a deck on a truck and had a lot of trouble. And when I come there, I had three trucks to put decks on with the hydraulics going up and everything like that. And the foreman had had all the trouble with his truck. And everybody waited to how mine was going to work. And everyone of mine worked perfect first time. And Jimmy came out with all the machinery that never worked. The labelling machines that he'd bought overseas and that. Those people couldn't get working. He thought I'd wave my hands and they'd all work. And so Jimmy put me in the can plant, running the can plant, making the cans. Because the body maker was bought by the Americans during the war and put into Watties. That's how he had the body made. And he made the cans with the stuff going overseas, supplying all the peas and that for the troops and that. Cans had to be lacquered, so they weren't in the bright sunshine as well. When I was working in Unilever, we'd go around adjusting the unions for the season and go to Watties, what we're going to do. And Jimmy would always come over and talk to me. And we both respected one another. And straight away, Unilever crowd yards of Jimmy would say, "You pinch our labour, Jimmy." And he'd say, "Claude and I don't go on for stealing one another's labour." And that was an unwritten story. If I had fitters come in for Watties wanting a job, "I'm sorry, mate, can't give you a job." And he would do the same with mine. We're both short of people. And we respect one another without robbing one another, you know.
You've certainly gained knowledge and experience.
Well, in our time, you can get sick of a job. You think, "I'll have a change." And see, I went into Watties and I said, "I come for a job." And they said, "Oh, I don't know if we'll give you a job." And I said, "Well, I don't know what place to work for. So that's pretty even. You don't know me and I don't know the place. I'll work for you for 3 weeks. You don't like me, you fire me." And so on the first job on the trucks, out come a rise for me.
That's great.
And any job that come up, it was always the chief engineer and me that went and sorted it all out, you know.
What are the biggest changes that you have witnessed in your lifetime?
Well, I was in Wellington when Hood and Moncrief threw the catchment, and we were standing out watching for the planes to come over, and the chap standing next to me said, "You know what? Sometime they'll bring all the mail over by plane." And I said, "Gee, would they?" Never thought of people, you know. All the mail would come over, "Gee, that would be great, you know." And that was back when Hood and Moncrief threw the Tasman in a little plane. They never arrived. They were lost, you know. And then you take flying now. When we went away on a holiday, we went by train. You went to the station, and it doesn't matter what the weather was, the train left. Today you go to the airport, you don't know if the plane's going to fly or not. You're there, the mercy there. When the railway went, the train would always went. If we're going to Auckland, we'd go to Palmerston. Then you go to the theatre in Palmerston, wait for the afternoon train to come through, catch the train and go to Auckland. So that's how you travel. But no, cars came right through from Model T forwards. I've travelled from Waipawa to Hastings with grass inside my tyre because I had a punch and didn't have any spare. So you took the tyre off and you filled the tyre with grass and everything and you come on the rest of the way with that. Talk about changing. Well, you take music. My mother always on payday bought a record. And I can remember she came home with the laughing policeman. And he was laughing away in there. So I pulled a long face and with a sour face and I didn't laugh. I was always a bugger of a kid.
Growing up, what was the worst day of your life?
Oh, the worst day of life? I don't know. Life's always been good to me. Oh, I rolled a car over. I rolled a car over in Dannyberg, that's how his nose was still broken. And you see there, head was on the road going down the road, and finished in the Dannyburg Hospital with a broken arm as well. The chap sitting next to me, he broke both wrists. It'd be a bad day.
How did you manage to do that?
Well, the wife was in the Wellington Hospital, and I had a little Austin 7 with a hood on it, you know. And I did it all up, and then in the weekend, took it down to Wellington to see her, and then come back. And I was on the way back when a little bolt broke in the tie rods underneath the steering, and the car shot up a bank and over and ran all the way down to the bank. Then a doctor picked us up and took us back to the hospital. He was in the car behind us. He was heading for Hastings. No, that'd be a bad day. But generally, all days are good.
So what was the best day of your life?
The best day of life. A lot of best days. Probably when I got married. That, I always remember that. Oh, every day's been a good day to me. I value every day. And today's a good day. And you'd say, well, you're sitting looking out there, but it's still a good day. I've got memories. I'm happy in a house. I've got the air pumps going. I go from one room to the other. I have the air pump all night in my bedroom. Mm-hmm. And then I come out here and I turn that one off and turn this one on here, have it here. You've got everything controlled for you. It's warm and everything. Life is so good today. Where in our days, you went out on the weekends and got wood and everything to keep the fires going. To buy wood to burn was a silly thing. So you worked on the weekends and got wood. You had a mate that went with you and you chopped, and that no saw, no electric saw like you'd have today, you'd get a load of wood in no time at all. Life is totally different. The mower, where you push the mower, it's got a motor on it now. It can be electric, you can take a choice what you want, you know. Life is so easy, you know. The ladies never had a washing machine. That was something that came in. I used to come home from work and wash the napkins so the wife would have another batch for next day. That was one of my jobs, to wash the napkins, get them dried in front of the fire so she could have some for next day to work. So you worked in like that. The life is easy today, you know. But that's the trouble, that when a girl gets married today, she's got to have everything. She's got to have a washing machine, a fridge, a this and that.
And all brand new.
All brand new. She doesn't want anything second hand. I worked with a chap. He made himself a washing machine, you know, and everything like that. So we made everything. We made the Christmas for the kids' tools. When the freezing works, you'd knock off work and the boss would come along and give you a job. I'm too busy, I've got to make this for the kid or something like that. And you know, you go to the paint shop and he'd get the paint off the painter. He'd go to the carpenter shop and he'd cut things out, cut a horse out, you know, these horses the kids put between their legs, mm-hmm. through a head on. He'd have the shape and he'd cut the head out for you and he'd supply the sticks and everything like that. Everybody worked in with one another, you know. Mm. Everybody was your friend.
And people had respect for one another.
Oh, yes.
They?
Oh, yes, you always respected anybody.
And your handshake was as good as a signature on a piece of paper, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, handshake was enough. If you said, I'm going to do that, today that still goes with me. You take people for their value. I used to bike out to Twyford there and fix up tractors and spray plants for people I knew and everything like that. In the season, they'd bring a case of fruit in there every now and then. Everything worked in like that. You know, you shared all the time. I got their plant going for them so they could spray. Their wife would ring me up and say, they'd be sent a message somehow to me that her husband had thrown the crank handle down the orchard somewhere and got so wild with it. That was life. You just thought nothing of it. You'd bike all the way. I biked to Waka too for 13 years. You talk about going to the gym today. They were all my grandchildren. I got to go to the gym. Got to go to the gym. What do you go to the gym for? Oh, I got to keep fit. I kept fit on my push bike getting to work. I was always late. And if I was really late, I'd go down the railway line, all the way down from Frederick Street to Waikato down the railway line, because the boss would be on the front gate to write your name down when he saw you. He never saw you come in the back gate. You knew how far to fiddle and what to do in those days, you know, to survive. You're a survivor.
Most men like cars. What was your best car?
Well, you bought cars and sold them. you know, all the time. I had a lot of cars. Cars with fabric on them and covered with fabric and little Morrises and that. And I had Morris Cowleys. I had Fords and everything like that. But, you know, that was it, you know. I could buy a car for £5. If I had £5, I could buy a car. I could buy a Model A Ford, and I could paint it all up. I could do it all up, and I could sell it for £100. That was my pocket money, because my wife would have the pay packet, and I would repair cars and do everything. After tea at night, I went out to the shed and worked till midnight. And then the next morning, I get up and go to work. So in my life, I've worked hard.
You have.
All my life. Even when I worked for Unilever, my job was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because I was harvesting, and they were harvesting right around the clock. And I knew everything at night, so I went on in the boat. And I had a married chap who looked after me and said, oh, they had trouble last night. Their foreman took them all into the pub at Teco. Well, I couldn't stand for that. Called him in, and I fired him. And I said, what are you going to do now? He said, I'm going to Australia. I said, you go to Tasmania, mention my name, and you'll get a job there straight away. And the P's there. And he did, he got a job there. He thought I was the greatest joker because I fired him and got him a job in Australia. But I was always fair with people. I always be fair with people, you know. I'd place myself in their position. And it's better they had a family. We try and look after them the best way we could, even if they had their holidays, and then you'd look to see, because you bring the next year's holidays forward to help them through, you know, because they had that money coming through to them. And people were very good. They'd go out of their way. The personnel department would go out of their way to help somebody, you know. I had an old joker working for me. He said, Claude, if I didn't have this job, I'd die. That chap died on the gate at 4 o'clock in the morning coming to work. The personnel department used to come along to me about once a year. He said, he's too old to work there. And I'd say, yeah, yeah, it's on my bucket list, I'm doing it. And then that would go on, I'd palm them off, and he would have his job for longer there. But they were worried that he was a boiler man. See, boiler men were hard to get. I was looking after myself as well as looking after him. But I always think that sprung in my mind. He died coming through the gate 4 o'clock in the morning to do his shift. And none of them made a boiler that exploded and killed the person out in front. He was looking after the boiler there, and it was going, and straight away this boiler blew up and it killed a person who was working out in front of the boiler. So I've had a terrible lot of experience. I just stripped that boiler down at night, work all night, checking the welds and everything in it, so ready to get the factory going next day. And the trouble with boilers was two boilers with one another, and this boiler was feeding steam to this boiler, and this boiler was out of water. And after that, all of New Zealand had to have non-return valves between two boilers right throughout New Zealand. So that fits that, really. So I've been amongst things like that, you know.
So your hobby would have been making all this stuff?
And keeping things going. I was trouble man for Unilever. If they had trouble in Christchurch, I'd fly down there, fix the trouble and fly back again. I remember one long weekend, I was stuck in Motueka, and I said to the factory manager, I've got to go home. So he drove me to Blenheim. I got the ferry from Picton across the strait, walked right around the wharf and got the Dominion car back here and right back here for the weekend. So yeah, there's always a way. It doesn't matter what your trouble was, there was always a way out.
Are you a gardener?
Well, I like my garden right. And my neighbour is very good to me. She just planted all my polyanthus for me. She took all the other plants out and put me polyanthus in. And she was the one that told me they're ready to come out. And she's the one that tells me what I got to do in the garden. But straight away, I keep my garden right, because the wife always did the garden too. When the boys come out in the Navy, they always wanted to go out and look at Mum's garden, you know. She did the vegetable garden, you know.
She had the green fingers.
Yeah, she was always the one. And she was so good, she'd direct things what we had to do, you know. One house I lived in, I had four lawns. So that was eight to the lawn to each son. And I could always tell which one wasn't mowing his lawn.
Now, what's your recipe for making it to 100?
The wife's good food. All the family, we put it down to a wife's good food. There was always the best of food. There was no cheap food or anything. You go to the butcher shop and he knew what Mrs. Davison wanted when he cut the beef up. It was either a rib with the bone taken out of it. And being in the freezing works, I always brought legs of lamb home from the freezing works and things like that. And the day the works opened, everybody took a fry home. We all got a fry there. The manager would send a note out, "We lost so many fries, so many white beds, so many this, so many that. We're watching from now on. We'll be prosecuted." But everybody took a fry home the first day of the kill. That was sad when the freezing works went from Hawke's Bay. When both Tamona and Wakatu, we never recovered from there. We're still going through it because everybody had a job in the season. The money rolled in. The off-season, the Maoris got their jobs, fencing and everything like that, going out fencing. And Hastings has never really recovered from then. It's sad, really, that they picked on two freezing works that closed down because there wasn't a number of sheep.
And yet they built their new one at Takapau.
At Takapau, they opened at Takapau. A mate of mine, I got him the job at the freezing works and he was chief engineer.
Now, when you were younger, did you ever think you'd live till you were going to be 100?
No. If I got past 60, I was satisfied.
70. Everybody,
that was the age that most people died at that age. Or, you know, they got weary or something like that. But my wife's grandmother, she died. She was very old. And her grandfather brought a steam engine into New Zealand when he immigrated. And he did a lot of the work over in New Plymouth for the barracks and that, cutting the timber. He supplied the wood for the first place up on Mount Egmont, you know, the ski lodge up there. He supplied the wood for that. So he opened a mill in New Plymouth. And the Maoris would tell him to bring the steam engine, put it away. There's trouble tonight, there's trouble brewing. So he got on well with the Maoris, you know. And, you know, we had relations with whalers and things like that. There was no woman in New Zealand. And this is what people immigrated out, thought that the Maoris and the Pākehās would all get together. The men would marry the Maori girls. So there would just be one race. And that was originally thought of in the early days, that it would just even itself out. But it hasn't worked out like that, you know. But I think it's improving. I think we're getting closer together all the time, you know.
There's very few true Maoris left now.
No, not true Maoris. Because my wife's grandfather was brought up in a pa. He was on the radio and he could tell all the birds, the songs of them, what they were all about, the birds in New Zealand, because he was brought up in a pa. So that was the early days, you know. His wife walked from New Plymouth to the Upper Hutt, walked there, because he shifted over there. She walked there to be with him, yeah.
So I saw the write-up in our local newspaper when you turned 103, and the photograph is of you blowing your candles out with a leaf blower.
Well, we've got a lot of old people. I go along to it's Hiratonga Old People's Club. We're very well set up. We've got two buses and a car, so we can go around. We lose a lot of people dying, going to homes and everything like that. And I come up with the idea that we would set up the club, do something about the club that we'd see. So if I had 103 candles on the cake, we'd get the fire brigade there to look after the fire in the building. And straight away, you know, I'd blow the candles out. They had to be candles that relit themselves again, in case I had trouble. And I really set it up and got the media down there so that that went out in the paper and the club knew about it and we could get more people coming into the club.
Publicity.
You get very short of people, you know, and helpers. We get short of helpers that are coming all the time like that. And I try to be the loud one in the club. When the people come along, we have people play the music and everything and sing along. And I said, no, one more volume here, not enough volume. Come on, sing up. Everybody knows me. Everybody knows Claude at the club, you know.
What are you going to do next birthday?
Well, I don't have any other birthday. I'm wearing out. I want to go out when I'm enjoying myself. You know, you can live too long. If I got a stroke, now I'm frightened of getting a stroke. If I got a stroke and was in the bed, well, I think, why didn't I die sooner before I got the stroke, you know? So not all good things are living a long time, because you spoil your life. I've had a good life, right through my life there. I couldn't have lived for it to be any better anyway. So why spoil it now with limping around, waiting for the undertaker to come and get me, you know? And I say to the wife every time I go and see her, put the kettle on, I'll be down soon. And she says, I've burned out so many bloody elements now, they won't give me any more.
Well, Mr. Davidson, it's been wonderful interviewing you this afternoon. I really appreciate you giving me your time.
Well, no, I'm pleased to give it to you. Because straight away, if people can see how people live in time and going on, you know, and I'd like to share it with them.
We really appreciate that. Yeah. We wish you all the very best.
But I try to make other people's lives good as well. If I got a good life, why can't I share it with somebody else and they have a good life?
That's why you're still here.
Yeah.
Take care.